to the 58th edition of Old School Guns, the podcast tells you like it is. Just to reiterate, you know that we're basically one-third 2A or national kind of news. Then we also do about a third of just kind of gun-related news and comment. And then we go into the best part, which is question and answers. You know, it doesn't exactly come out to thirds, but depending on what's in the news. So anyway, we will get right to it. Okay, everybody's seen the impeachment nonsense. Everybody knows it's basically garbage. You know, the latest thing is, you know, this John Bolton, the guy with the weird mustache and all that. He's written a book, and the book has been leaked, and apparently it was this guy Vindman's brother who was supposed to be going through the book to see if it had anything bad in it, and he may have leaked it. I mean, who knows? This is all soap opera drama. The bottom line is, there is no case, but this should be a powerful lesson to everyone. We need to mobilize voters and get rid of elected Democrats. I mean, just get rid of them at all levels, in the Senate, in the House, local and state level. I mean, you can't trust these people. They're going after gun rights like crazy. So far, we've been hitting them back pretty hard. But, you know, when they get in the majority, if they capture the Senate and the White House, then we're going to be in real trouble. It'll make 1994 look pretty mild by comparison. So this election, get out. Get off the twin 50s. Open the wallet and, actively work campaign and donate to pro-gun candidates. That's all we can do. That's all we can do. And if we do that, we might send a powerful lesson. I hope the Virginia rally sent them a powerful lesson, but definitely the ballot box will send them the most powerful lesson. Okay, a couple things. Every once in a while you see these kind of garbage posts or on YouTube, or you see these especially in some of these magazines, you know, and that's these guys who I guess it's some unrequited deal they have going on, but they have to pose like super bad dudes with weapons, you know. And a lot of these guys, you know, it's the goatee, it's the tactical goatee, they're in the military style clothes, and they got the grimace, you know, the whole thing going on. And you know, the funny part is the guys who have actual military or law enforcement experience, you rarely see them doing that, if ever. I mean, you don't see them really doing that. You'll see them pose, but they don't have anything to prove. So they're not trying to be this intimidating look, like I'm super bad with this, you know, $3,000 AR-15 or whatever kind of nonsense they're holding in their hand. I've always thought it was really funny. One of the ones I saw was, if you remember that horrible TV show, Sons of Guns, where the guy was eventually convicted of molesting his children, and it was just evil, evil, evil. Well, his adult daughter, who had married one of the guys on the show, the guy who became the son-in-law, no military or LE experience, but this guy had a whole bunch of photos of him looking like a real, you know, bad dude, mercenary type kind of guy. And you know, I they were just funny because you look and you say, well, what's this guy's background? It turns out he has no background. There's no background. There's no reason for him to be that way. You see the same thing. I mentioned it before. When you're looking at these survivalist or prepper kind of magazines, and there's actually two or three of them out on the, I see them on the shelf in the supermarket where I'm sure the vast majority of the wannabe preppers are, is in the supermarket. But these guys are really funny. You know, they always, the pictures they have are these guys, you know, they kind of look like Blackwater contractors, you know, kind of fit and, you know, with the tactical beard and all the cool, you know, kind of equipment and everything. When in actuality, the preppers that I've seen are just ordinary people, and they come in all sizes and shapes and everything else. And so they don't really look like these magazine models of toughness, you know. And especially with the prepper vehicle, you know, you always see some kind of Hummer or some sort of high speed vehicle with all of the doodads on it. I've mentioned this before, but since it keeps happening, it's just so funny. And you know, where the actual prepper vehicles that I've seen are usually in very poorer condition, at least on the surface. You know, they're kind of beat up and everything else. So it's a lot of fun. The difference between the perception and the reality are really pretty comical. So, as a matter of fact, on I can't remember if it's Netflix or Amazon Prime or something. They have that old show that they had a few years ago, Doomsday Preppers. And you can watch Doomsday Preppers on there. And I mean, it's even more silly now than it was during the height of the Obama years when people were like, well, you know, what do they talk about? FEMA camps and, you know, black helicopters. And the best one was the Mayan calendar's going to run out. So, you know, the world is coming to an end because, you know, the Mayan calendar, everybody has to pay attention to that. So anyway, all of that, and you see some of those shows and how some of those people are living, and you makes you wonder. You know, the next series should be, hey, what do the Doomsday Prepper guys go show by show and say, well, what are they doing now? Are they still actually living that way, or what's happened? You know, especially the guy who's going to supplement his income by gathering rattlesnakes and milking their venom in Arizona. I don't know about you, but if I'm worried about saving my life being a prepper, I think the last thing I want to mess with is trying to milk rattlesnake venom. That just doesn't seem like that's very, no matter how good you are, it only takes one mistake and you're in some pretty serious trouble. So, you know, it'd be interesting to see show by show who is actually where and what's still going on. I would be willing to wager that most of them are doing something else now and are not as heavily into it as they were. That's just my guess. But I think those things are a lot of fun. And, you know, sometimes people take themselves way too seriously. These guys with the grimace and, you know, all that stuff, it's like, you know, you're not really a gunfighter. You're not a guy who's actually even chosen to live the lifestyle of service that could put you in harm's way. So why do you want to look like you're this really really bad hat who's out there, you know, with your weapon and all that? Especially the ones where the guys, like, you know, they're lawyers or something on some of these blogs or video channels. So it's really funny to me. I enjoy that. Now, I'm not saying that people who don't have military or LE experience aren't, you know, they can't be serious about guns and serious about self-defense. No, I think they are. And the people I know who fit in that category are very sane and very good, and they don't do a lot of the nonsense. You know, it's amazing what sells magazines, and a lot of that stuff is just amazing. You kind of are seeing a comeback of the gun magazine a little bit. I think people enjoy having something they can put in their briefcase or backpack and look at their leisure that's not dependent upon the batteries of their smartphone or tablet. So I think, you know, the kind of the bright spot is for the print media anyway. There is a market, and there are a couple of magazines out there. A lot of them don't really, well, there's not a lot of them, but there's a few of them that really don't interest me very much. But I think hand loader is always going to be very interesting to people who hand load. And there's a few others. Unfortunately, the golden age is long gone, and we just don't have the gun writers that we used to, kind of the personalities. You know, you don't have even if you disagree with them, you don't have the Jeff Coopers and the Bill Jordans and Skeeter Skelton and all these kind of guys who did a very, very kind of specific thing. So, you know, you don't have that anymore. You just kind of have these guys who are just out reiterating and The fact of the matter is they're just recycling a lot of older material, and you can get most of everything they say is on the internet. The internet is an incredible resource, and that's why people don't buy very many gun books anymore, and that's why they don't buy a lot of the reference materials, or that's why there's no market for, gun DVDs or anything, just simply because it's all available out there for nothing. All you have to do is get online, and there you go. So, anyway, another thing I want to talk about, and it was kind of fun. Here in my part of the country, I actually put it on, and the club I'm a member of basically stands behind it. It's called Red Dawn, Kansas. Red Dawn, Kansas. And this started a year ago, and only a few of us showed up because it was below zero. But the genesis of this was, we really were at a point where there wasn't a lot of things happening during the winter here in the Midwest. Outdoor shooting, if you're having a mild winter, you can do some of it. If you're having a severe winter, a lot less gets done. So, everyone was kind of bored. There weren't any kind of competitions to do. So, we kind of came up with, well, what could we do in the cold weather? And also, what would be unique in the cold weather? Not just doing something that we would normally do during the summer where it's nice and warm and comfortable and everything else, but what could we do that would be, very, very cool in the cold weather? So we decided that, hey, shooting some rifles offhand at shorter range would be interesting. And of course, we gravitated towards Soviet weapons because, we kind of think of the Cold War. The cold of the Cold War has two meanings. Number one was the fact that it wasn't a raging conflict with armies clashing against each other. But the other fact was, if you were stationed in Germany or if you were stationed in Korea, you were out doing your thing in the cold. So Cold War kind of had two meanings for us. So we decided that, hey, we would use basically Soviet-style weapons. So it just didn't turn into another AR-15, whatever else kind of match. So, we decided that we would do that, and we had three portions of it. One was pistol, one was rifle at about 40 yards, firing on a Canadian short-range rifle target, and the other was a longer range, a 300-yard. Kind of a DMR type of deal. The first one we held, it was actually below zero. We got through the first two stages, but basically there were so few of us, we decided to essentially modify the third stage and just shoot at gongs from benches because, you put your body on the ground, even with a shooting pad or something nice, the heat just gets sucked out of you immediately, no matter how you're dressed. Pretty tough. It's pretty. Pretty tough, and we didn't want to have that kind of misery. So we decided that maybe that wasn't a part of the match that really needed to be replicated. That we could do that kind of shooting under other conditions. And one of the it does open your eyes to the guys who were in the Battle of the Bulge or a Chosin Reservoir or some of these other places where we associate very, very cold battles, cold, not even counting going farther back to Valley Forge and other places where people were actually freezing to death, type of deal. It's a very, very big deal operating in the cold weather sometimes. And people who've been stationed in Alaska certainly know this. And then there are certain places around the United States, Rocky Mountains, upstate New York, a few other kind of bases that are around the United States. People kind of know this. So anyway, we took Soviet weapons, and this year we had since we're having a much more mild winter, it was still below freezing, but it wasn't anywhere near zero. It was in the high 20s. We had people come out and fire the pistol, fire the rifle. Really had a good time, and it serves another purpose. It serves the purpose of testing your not only your technique, but how does your weapon interface with your clothing, as they would say, or how does the way you're dressed How does that influence your shooting? I mean, if you're wearing heavy, thick gloves, you certainly aren't going to get the kind of trigger pull. So, what do you do then? Do you try to go with some sort of trigger mitten where you got your index finger free, or do you go with a set of gloves where you stick them inside of mittens to keep your hand warm, but then you pull them out and maybe you have your index finger exposed so you can get that good purchase on the trigger. It's really about technique and what you want to do, and it does affect your accuracy. But if you can overcome those things, the next hurdle is how does your weapon and ammo perform in the cold? And we saw a couple of things. I explained last podcast about my Yugo M57. It did not do well at 16 degrees. I don't know why, and I'm going to, try to replicate that and figure out what the deal is. We saw Tokarev do the same thing. And is it sometimes is it the ammo? Is it the lubrication? Is it something else? And that's what you have to, that's one of the nice things that's there to discover. One of the things we do discover is that essentially military grade weapons work very well in that cold weather. Things like the M1 Garand, certainly the G3, certainly AKs, all that stuff works very, very well. And I think next year we may even expand. We kind of had an experimental class called the Resistance class, where you could just kind of bring anything, kind of looking at 1980s and before, kind of looking at that. We didn't really specify that, but that's what it turned out to be. So, maybe we'll have a few ARs show up, and I'm sure they'll do just fine. But, knowing how to lubricate and do things in the cold is very different. And, it's really a pleasure when you have your magazines preloaded and you're not losing your fingers, losing the heat out of your fingers, the way I was talking about the last podcast. That really shows you that what it's like to operate in the cold, and how your hands are your most vul your hands and your feet are your most vulnerable part. If you've got good socks and good boots, your feet are going to be okay. But you have to have good gloves for your hands, and then you also have to be careful how you use your hands and what kind of cold you expose them to. Because even very good gloves, the heat leaves your fingers, and your fingers get very, very cold, and that can be miserable. You can still do it, but it can be miserable. So, Red Dawn, Kansas was a very interesting experience, and I think a lot of gun clubs around, if you have outdoor ranges and you were looking for something to do in the winter, go with some sort of theme match like that, where people can use in competition weapons that have the attributes of doing very well in the cold. And certainly this was it. So hopefully we'll do it again next year. I don't see any obstacles or any reasons why not. And it should be even better. Every year it's been getting better. And so for the third year, I'm hoping that it still continues to improve. So anyway, from there, we can now go into my favorite part, which is questions and answers. Because I really like these, because I like the kind of questions people ask. So, our first question: do you believe in Sasquatch? And parenthetically, Bigfoot. Yes, I know what that is. And what weapons would you use if you were hunting or investigating Bigfoot? Well, first of all, I hate to be a downer, but no, I really don't believe in it. Now, when I was a kid, I actually lived up where they filmed that famous, Gimlin, what do they call it? The Patterson-Gimlin tape, video. I lived very close to there, and I even still watch some of the TV shows that do that. But that's up near a place called the Marble Mountains, and that's where I lived in Northern California. And everybody was kind of Bigfoot crazy back then, and there wasn't, we didn't have the trail cams or any of the kind of good stuff we have now. So, people would find the footprints and all that. And while I admit that there is always this nebulous, compelling evidence, there's always there's always these, blurry shots or of a, photographs or blurry video, or these, kind of non-specific looking prints, but there's never a smoking gun. There's never the great piece of evidence. And I think we would have found it by now. I think that with all the people who've been looking for Bigfoot for the last 60 years, I think they would have found a carcass or a bone or something. They would have found something, or at least had very definitive trail cam footage. I just think they would have. I mean, I know it's a big country. The Pacific Northwest is a big country. But I also think that, there are a lot of people who think they see something. Eyewitness reporting, which is really what the crux of all this is, because there's so little physical evidence and what there is very nebulous. But all these eyewitness reports, eyewitness reporting is notoriously unreliable. So I kind of just think that until they can produce something solid, you have to come down on the no. And that's a change. When I was a kid, I thought, hey, they must be out there somewhere, and someday we're going to find it. But I don't think it's out there, and I don't think we're ever going to find it. I think, unfortunately, I think Bigfoot is in everyone's imagination. But if there was a Bigfoot, if there was a Sasquatch, what weapons would you use if you were hunting or investigating Bigfoot? And I would say that that's based on the premise that a Sasquatch or Bigfoot would be hostile, or at least have demonstrated some sort of hostility or hostile actions. So I would say that you really don't need, because nobody sees Bigfoot. Nobody sees Bigfoot at long range. Nobody looks through their scope and spotting scope and sees Bigfoot 500 yards away picking berries or hauling a deer back to wherever it is Bigfoots live. So I would have to say that if you encountered a Bigfoot, it would probably be at insanely close range, and at that point, you're probably looking at, probably within 12 gauge shotgun, slug or buckshot type of range. But if you wanted to be a little more, wanted to have a little more, saying, well, what if I saw him 50 yards away and he's throwing big boulders at me or something? I would say that you would be very, very well equipped with a semi-automatic 308 7.62 by 51 NATO rifle, probably with a decent, some kind of an optic, not necessarily a magnified optic, but the red dot or the EOTech or something. That would be the kind of thing I would use. Probably the EOTech that is compatible with night vision, since they only seem to come out at night. And I suppose for handguns, I guess bigger would be better if you're talking about a creature that weighs, 400 to 700 pounds or something. Obviously, that's going to be a large bore handgun. That's not going to be, and probably a Magnum, even though people say don't use Magnums for self-defense. In that case, it'd be just like a defense against a hostile bear or a tiger or some other kind of creature that's big and very ornery. But the truth of the matter is, since I don't really believe in Sasquatch, that's all just kind of the thoughts on my head. But that's that. And let's go to the next question. Do you use a chronograph for your hand loads or factory ammo? And this is going to be heresy to other hand loaders and other people, but I've actually never used a chronograph. And I've never really felt the necessity to use it. And here's why. It's because I don't load ammunition to the top end. If I do, I switch calibers and go to a larger, if I need that capability, I switch and go to a larger caliber or a more powerful caliber. I like kind of mid-range kind of loads, certainly below maximum. Somewhere in between maximum and minimum is kind of where I find the sweet spot. And really, when I hand load, I look for accuracy. I don't really look for power. The difference between if my 7.62 NATO is going out at 2,600 feet per second as opposed to 2750. It really doesn't matter to me if it's an accurate load. Really doesn't matter because most of the stuff I do, accuracy is a little more important than velocity. And also, those kind of loads are easier on the firearm. They just are, and they're easier on the barrel. They generate a little less heat. So I don't load the top end of anything. So if I do, I just grab something bigger. So I don't really use a chronograph. The chronographs, most of the ones that I was used to, and the reason I never got into the habit of using them was the goofy screens and that whole thing on a tripod. All of that kind of stuff really turned me off. You know, if the wind's blowing, that thing's liable to topple over, all that. So I was never a fan of those types of things. They do have the kind that fit on, like they call them bayonet mounts. You know, it kind of fits on the barrel, kind of looks like a plastic bayonet type of a protrusion. Those are actually, you know, look pretty good as, and the best look are probably the Doppler radar ones, which the extended long range guys use. Now, I will say that if I was doing that kind of shooting, I would probably by necessity have to use one so that, you know, you can figure out how fast your bullets are going so that you can fit them into the mathematical models to give you the scope adjustments for the very long ranges. So, since I don't really do that, I don't really need that kind of capability. So I don't need a little bench-mounted radar that'll measure my bullet's velocity. So I don't really use them, but I do see that they do have a practicality and a use. I think the best data you can get from them is probably standard deviation when it comes to accuracy. You know, how close are they together? And have you done something in your loading process, or is the type of ammunition you've purchased consistent enough to give you the kind of accuracy you want? And that to me is the big benefit from them. Certainly not really speed, you know. You can always kind of guesstimate speed from the published data you're using. Okay, here is the next question. What advice would you give gun clubs to increase female participation? That's difficult. I think, well, there seems to be plenty of female participation, but you know, there are probably more people who would participate if they felt a little more comfortable, or if the entrance into shooting was a little easier for them. So I would say that the best thing that clubs could do would be have a ladies program, just like they have youth programs, where maybe they can, you know, have some sort of mentorship or some sort of camaraderie where people can come in and they can continue to bring in kind of newer shooters who, I guess going to a shooting range for a woman is kind of, in many ways, like going to gyms were in the old days. You know, you kind of show up, maybe you're the only female in there, everybody's kind of looking at you, and you don't necessarily feel comfortable. So I think shooting ranges can sometimes have that same ambiance. You know, the guys working behind the counter are almost always men. There's probably, of all the, if you've got 20 shooters there, probably 18 of them are men, you know. So I think that, you know, kind of making it a little easier, making for some clubs, I think if you have nicer facilities too, you know, some gun clubs like the one I belong to has got some, because of financial responsibility, has got some very austere facilities there. I mean, it's got nice, it's nice, it's a nice bathroom, you know, concrete floor and all the good things, but it's not the kind of place where you would lounge around, and it's not particularly inviting to females. So realizing that we're making very general statements because there's some female shooters that show up there, but I'm just addressing the question broadly and generally speaking, realizing that there are many exceptions. So that those are the things I would do. I would have a ladies club or a ladies auxiliary or a ladies mentorship program, whatever that was. And I would also kind of spruce up the facilities so it doesn't look like you're going into a Quonset hut in you know, somewhere in South Vietnam or something, you know. So that's what I would do to increase it. And I think a lot of the higher end clubs, you notice that there are some indoor ranges that are very, very nice, where they have a very, very, I'll say for me, kind of an upscale store that sells the very, very nice gear and also some, ladies kind of, outdoor fashion stuff. They have all that, and those are all pretty squared away. So, there's a market there, and I think that, some of the individual clubs now kind of have to get on and understand that there's a lot more shooters that would participate if they just change their model, their business model a little bit. Okay. Are there any or were there any gun-oriented TV shows that are any good? I have to say the answer to that is niet. No, nein, niet. I've never liked them. I've always thought that they have this kind of low production value. And there were some actually, I don't get the outdoor channel, so I don't get the. I understand the Joe Mantegna one, Gun Stories, was pretty good. I always liked Midway USA's Cowboys. I thought that was kind of a fun show. And it wasn't really, an expensive, high budget show, but it was pretty good. But the cowboy action shooting is kind of, I think it may be past its zenith. I'm just guessing that. I don't know, but it just seems like it's kind of past its zenith a little bit. So the interest in that didn't, you also can't run a cowboy shooting TV series for 10 years or 15 years. You run out of material at some point. And that's where we started to get into the kind of the fake reality shows. There was the, we talked about him a little bit earlier, the Sons of Guns guy, the child molester, and all that fake drama that was in his show. And then there was the guy in Colorado. He also got into legal trouble, I believe, over his FFL, if I remember right. And yeah, something about doing transfers. A lot of these guys, you think it's, oh, the gun shop, and this guy's the owner. And it turns out that somebody else has the FFL, and, they're kind of just doing these things in front for the camera, the transfers. And, it's all that kind of hokiness. And I really think that, they tried that several times, and it really hasn't worked. The reality gun TV show just really doesn't work, even if you're a hardcore hobbyist. Just really doesn't happen. So, I don't think any of those were any good, and I don't think any of them are ever really going to come back. I don't think you'll see any of that. The ones that kind of gain traction are the hunting shows. God knows I've tried to watch them. I find them just pitifully boring. Guys going around talking in whispers and, clunking around with the camera. I can't go there. Part of that is I don't really do any hunting. So maybe to hunters there's some magic there, but yeah, that's that kind of stuff is just horrible to watch. And so I think that people watch that only if they're pretty bored and desperate. Again, shooting is a participation sport. And it's not meant to be a kind of a spectator TV phony show sport. It's meant to be exactly kind of what it is. You go out and do, and it's not really something that you watch on TV. So therefore, those things are just kind of a failure to me. I don't think there's, and it's kind of a shame because we do have to get shooting to the new. The positive aspects of shooting have to be communicated to the public at large and also to people who are, kind of on the fringe of the sport and want to come in, but, all they see are bad things and the anti-gun propaganda that's out there. So we do need to get the good news story out there. So I don't know how that's going to be, but they've definitely got to try another formula than what I've seen so far. Okay, next question is do you fire large caliber weapons such as cannons? The answer is no, I do not. And well, I have a a 69 caliber cannon, you know, one of those very cool little kit that came out some years ago. And it's pretty cool to fire, you know, but you know, that's really kind of a basically a musket size deal, and it's very small. It's not the full size, you know, Napoleon cannon from the Civil War type deal. You know, this is something a lot smaller. Let me just say that, first of all, I think that, you know, it's a very daunting task to fire something that's very large and powerful. And by daunting task, I think I'm really trying to say that, you know, it takes a lot of expertise and a lot of training, and sometimes it takes more than one person to do that. And it's also somewhat a little bit dangerous. I mean, there was a case a few years ago where a guy who had a Civil War cannon, and I don't know if he was a reenactor or if he just had a cannon, and it was Civil War style cannon. I don't think it was an original. And they were out firing it, and lo and behold, the shot just kind of, you know, after it flew for a long time, it kind of bounced along the ground and hit somebody's house. So that was one case. There have been other cases though that haven't ended so well. One was, and it was on a TV show, Tank Overhaul or something. Guy had an M10 tank destroyer or M18 tank destroyer. I don't know what it precisely was, but he had the legally registered cannon and everything. And eventually, you know, sometime after the TV show was filmed, maybe a year or two later, the thing blew up and killed him and one other man who was inside the turret. And I think nobody kind of knew what all that was, but you know, there's some very, very specific things that crewmen do when there's a misfire or when there's a problem with one of these large weapon systems. And if you fire it and it goes click, you pull the trigger and it goes click, you don't immediately open the breech because it could be a hang fire, and then once you've opened the breech, that thing could explode inside. They thought that's what happened in this tank destroyer, but in point of fact, I think they actually looked, and when the guy rebuilt the cannon, he had kind of pieced it together and used a breech ring from something else, and the breech ring is what failed. And it was probably the reason it was probably around and available was it had been taken off one for service a different cannon system for serviceability issues. And you know, sometimes there's no way to know that because there's no magic way to X-ray or find these things out. And if they've got a deep inherent fault, there's just no way to know. And you know, there have been, you know, there are gunnery accidents in military service. They're very rare, but they do happen. And to think that everything is completely 100% safe, especially when the people rebuilding it may have knowledge, but do they have the correct knowledge to make that all happen, be safe, and everything else? And so, you know, firing these large caliber weapons, now those are cannons, you know, we're talking about cannons on these things or Civil War type cannons. It's a question of can you safely fire it, which is the case of the tank destroyer, or do you know where that projectile is actually going to wind up, which was the case with the Civil War cannon that the guy, Civil War style cannon that the guy was shooting. You know, there are some other things that are not quite as dramatic, and that is, you know, there are 20 millimeter, there are 14.5 caliber, 12.7, which is 50 caliber. There are some of those out there now too, and you know, people have to understand that these things aren't just like shooting a regular small arm that we're used to, you know, a rifle caliber deal. These things have a lot longer range, a lot more kinetic energy, a lot more power, and they may have some other characteristics that are completely different as far as ricocheting or doing something else. So I don't fire anything that large or that dramatic. If you know, if I were living in, you know, the Badlands somewhere, and I had just all these incredible miles to shoot, you know, something like that might be a little more appealing. I've seen some pictures of Utah, and I imagine that South Dakota and some other places are the same way, where you can get on these cliffs, these bluffs, and you can just see for miles, and there's nobody there, and you can do some incredible long-range shooting. But that's not where I am, so therefore I don't use those, and I don't really recommend that. I'd say you have to be a real expert to know. I know a military vehicle guy who he had to buy himself a semi-automatic 50 cal, and frankly, there's some things that are neat to own, and there are some things that are just impractical to own. An M2 50 caliber machine gun that's been worked and remanufactured into a semi-automatic, that is a still a daunting piece of equipment to use. You still have to set the headspace and a few other things that if it goes wrong, you could wind up with a problem. The other thing is, as you get a little older, do you really want a weapon with a 75-pound receiver and all that? We've talked about that kind of stuff before. It might be fun, but is it impractical? And if you have it, how often are you really going to use it? A lot of people have talked about the water-cooled machine guns and things, but getting all of that out to the range, you find you're doing it like once every 2 years or 3 years, rather than doing it two or three times a year or once a month, like you are with your regular small arms. So that's kind of the deal on those cannons. You have to be careful. You have to look at what is not only what would be cool, but what would be practical. Some other weapons that really, you have to look at their practicality are, as much as I would like to have one, the semi-automatic BAR is the same way. If you don't have a, if you got a little bit of a tweaked back, like most of us have, that's a heavy gun to be hauling around, just hauling it from one place to another, moving it from one place to another. It's a very heavy rifle, and may not be the best choice for someone unless you absolutely have to have it because of its historical importance. Same thing can happen with just about anything else. A lot of these 50 BMG rifles that are not necessarily, well, the Barretts fall into that, but also the other ones. There's a a host of these things, and how practical is it? Do you really want it? And is it something you can really use? And those are the questions that you really have to look at and answer for yourself. Okay, here's the next question. The 30-40 cartridge and the Krag rifle served for only a short time in U.S. service. Was there a better option available at the time of the Krag's adoption? Well, that's a very interesting question, and I have to say that I think that there were a lot of better, well, I don't know about a lot, but there certainly were better choices. The problem with the Krag was the way it loaded. It was never it did not have the Mauser loading system, so it was going to be a pain. It was just not going to be fast as the Mauser rifles were. So it was already essentially outmoded when it was adopted by the U.S. military. It was already kind of an obsolete dead end loading system, just the way it is. Running the gamut, there's nothing wrong with the 30-40 cartridge. It was a good cartridge. Being rimmed always introduced some problems, but that's just kind of the way that goes. Had it been rimless, it would have probably not been replaced by the 30-06. It would have just been chambered into the new service rifle. It was a very, very good cartridge. However, you could look and say, hey, alternative history being what it is, there was always the 6.5 Swede in Krag rifles. So what if they just adopted the Norwegian Krag rifle in 6.5 and said, hey, we're good, we'll just get these right off the shelf type of deal, pick them off. The reason why that never happened was there was, reducing caliber is always a controversy. Look at the 7.62 by 51 NATO versus 5.56. That's just the latest chapter. But these, reducing caliber has always been a very contentious issue. So, as a matter of fact, Krag bullets you can still find. You used to be able to find them a lot more than you do now, but you used to be able to find Krag bullets that had the military Krag ammunition, a US 30 caliber Krag ammunition that would have the nose of the bullet kind of cut off at the jacket and have an X cut into the lead as a way to help it expand. Not a very Probably didn't work at all. Probably was futile. But it just shows you people wanted, did not trust smaller caliber. And at that time, 30 caliber was a small caliber. So going even smaller would have been a mistake. And I don't think that the Navy and the Marines were really happy with the 6 millimeter Lee Navy. So, 30 caliber was as small as they were going to go. So the 6.5 Krag would have been off the table. Two others that would have been really good choices were the Model 91 Argentine, which had been adopted by Belgium, then Argentina. That is a very, very good cartridge and a very, very good rifle, kind of a push style, ahead of its time type of a rifle. Very, very good. And it would have stood up much better in the Spanish-American War than did the Krag. Krag wasn't as bad as people say, but it wasn't that great either, But the Argentine rifle would have been a much better choice. Another excellent choice would have been the Model 93 Mauser in 7 millimeter Mauser, the same ones the Spanish had. That would have been a very good choice also, as it was found to be a very serviceable and very effective combat weapon. So that would have been a great choice also. And again, that would have meant the U.S. military might have stayed with 7 millimeter Mauser, 7x57, maybe up through the end of the Second World War or even beyond. That might have become the 30-aught, the cartridge that the 30-06 became. It might have been that widely popular, that widely used. So that's interesting to think about. Another possibility would have been the Mosin 91 was still out there. It would have been in the original, incantation, and actually they were made in France. They probably could have been negotiated the rights and made that. That would have been a good rifle. I mean, a lot of people dog out Mosins. I don't. I actually think that, for that time frame, it would have been good. One of the problems with adopting something like the Krag or the M1891 Mosin Nagant or the Model 93 Mauser was that basically, there was such a rapid evolution of military rifles between 1885 and about 1910 that, really, no matter what you chose, it was going to be kind of outclassed by the 98 Mauser. That's just kind of the way that was. The 98 Mauser was going to kind of make everything else not so much obsolete. Or as they say on InRange TV, obsolescent, but it was definitely a better system. So consequently, anything you would have adopted would have come up a little bit short. And for the timing, the 1903 Springfield, which borrowed heavily from the 1896 Mauser and the 1898 Mauser, that was pretty much the equal of the 98 Mauser, and so. You can look and say, well, things actually worked out for the best, and the Krag was just a stopgap. But there were a lot better choices out there, and I think had those been made, we would have had maybe a different cartridge, maybe even a different cartridge culture, where 30-06 and 30 caliber was not, as widely used, and maybe we would have been a 7 millimeter, culture or something else. So. Very interesting to think about, but there were other choices. The Krag was very beautifully made, very reliable, and it was amply powerful. And it could keep up, but it just wasn't optimal. And there was no future for the Krag system, beyond the countries of origin. I think Denmark had one, but beyond Scandinavia, Krag was just the Krag, and it didn't really get it didn't really proliferate because the system just wasn't, it just was not state of the art. So that's what went on with that. There could have been other choices. Well, that's it for another edition of Old School Guns. As always, we are on Podbean, and you can always leave your comments there. But also, you can also hit like, hit follow, hit any of those buttons because we definitely appreciate the people who do that. And go ahead and leave us questions if you like, or go ahead and contact us with any other comments that you have. But for now, this is Old School Guns out.